He stands up and looks down at her.
"You won't replace me,"
he says, quietly, more calmly than before. Then he kneels back down and runs his fingertips around the outline of her body, as if he is checking for something. For about half a minute, he holds his index finger and middle finger against the side of her throat. He stands again, his back to me. I'm relieved not to see her eyes. We stand there for some time, just waiting, just looking. Everything is fading, and I notice that the last few minutes have been riddled by a sharp clarity in which I could see, smell, and hear every little detail. The taste of the fried aubergine lingers on my tongue. As we walk out of the kitchen and into the hallway, the space around me pulses in shocked white. The walls are gone. The front door is vague, as if shrouded in mist. I stand still in the doorway as Yarick walks down the path and out onto the street. His hood is back up. He looks around once, twice, three times, and then he is gone. I wait here, guarding Sarah's body, wishing that someone other than her mother and two daughters could find her. He is going to die in safety, where they will ensure he reaches his heaven. This poor dying man, with a loving wife and a madly jealous mistress. But I've seen the truth. I've seen an obsessive dying man, with a wife who had finally found the courage to walk away from him in both life and death, and a gullible, convenient mistress to whom he played the victim. As I come around, I feel like I'm waking into either an earthquake or a bomb, until I realize that Daniel, Jess, and Luke are holding me down to the bed. I am shaking with a violence that matches the pressure of Yarick's thumbs around Sarah's neck. I can't breathe in, and I can't make any noise come out. I just gulp pointlessly at the air and let myself convulse until it starts to ease. I focus on the insistent pressing of Daniel's hands upon my upper arms. I let him lay me back onto the bench, and gradually, the oxygen returns to my lungs. I look around at their faces, and they all stare back at me, wide-eyed, as if I'm a bizarre, unknown creature they've brought back from a deep and distant jungle. Everyone is staring at me open-mouthed. "You got it, right?" I splutter. "You saw it all?" They nod in unison, and I take several deep breaths. I listen for the beat of my heart in my chest. Bleary-eyed, I look around at the parts of the room I can see without moving my head. It is all a little darker than I remember, but it is here. It is real. I press my fingertips into the bench beneath me and draw comfort from its cool hardness. "You did well," says Daniel. "Take your time." And yet they continue to watch me, as if they're waiting for me to do something. I slide my arm over my chest and face to my head. It feels too heavy to lift. "I want these gone," I say, running my palm over my scalp. "They're gone," Jess says. "I already took them out." She gestures across the room to a bloody beaker. I see the metal against the glass at the same time as I realize I can't feel the cool circles beneath my hair. Jess leans over me and slips her arms awkwardly around my neck, squeezing me gently. She tells me how brave I am, and how proud of me she is. I hum into her ear. You need to rest now, Isabel, she says, then turns to Daniel.
You need to let her go home.
Daniel looks at me and then back at Jess.
I need to take her back to the station first, but hopefully...
If she needs bail, Jess adds.
It's either charge or release at this stage, but this... This should be enough.
If you need me to come down and talk it through, explain it to people, whatever, then I'm happy to, Jess says.
I feel like a child standing between her parents as I look from one to the other, letting them discuss my future in front of me. And if you need somewhere to stay, Iz, she says, squeezing me around the shoulders,
well, you know where I am.
I'm not sure I want to spend another hour in a lab, I say. I feel a weak smile slink across my face as I realize I've made a joke.
I do have a home, you know.
Jess rolls her eyes at me.
She needs to rest, too. The pressure on her has been immense. Taking responsibility for me, for my life, for the heavens of the people she watches over.
I don't know how she does it. Chapter 33. 6 weeks later. All this technology, and still something as simple as removing a tattoo, is both time-consuming and uncomfortable. I've been rubbing in the cream for weeks now, each morning and evening. With my little finger, I've pushed it into the lines until the skin of my ankle has paled beneath the pressure. The formula calls out to my white blood cells, asking them to come and clear away the ink that corrupts me. Particle by particle, the ink has been carried to my lymph nodes and erased. It's almost like it never happened. My angel has faded now, to a pale grey outline of what she once was, much like the memory of the past months in my mind. The time has come to get rid of it completely, to remove the lines that I have drawn through my life. I'm walking the long way, I suppose. I've finished shopping, but the lights of Regent Street are too beautiful not to stroll beneath on such a dry, crisp winter's evening. I've just bought my last gift, and I feel in my pocket for the edges of the small box. Leela had always wanted this necklace. Maybe I'll wear it for her. I draw my hands into the cold air and clutch at the lapels of my coat, pulling it tightly around my neck. The faux fur tickles reassuringly on my cheeks, which are sensitive in the cold air. Despite the tears in my eyes, the atmosphere draws me into its frenzied grasp, and it's easy to be swept along with all these other pink, wind-bitten faces, peeping out from thick coats and glowing with festive fever. I can smell the tempting aroma of the outdoor stalls, which cluster at each junction, roasting sugary nuts and sweet chestnuts. Families and couples flow past me, loaded with bags and dazzled by the elaborate window displays that line the street. This year's lights hang above us, looking like an amped-up version of the night sky. Older children point out the constellations to their younger siblings, naming Orion and the Plough. Every so often, I pass under a planet. I almost feel the need to duck below Jupiter, which floats above my head, swirling in creamy reds and oranges like a giant bauble. The London scenery that surrounds me is almost distracting enough for my purposes. But then I glimpse a man pushing back his red hair. I'm jolted into thinking it's Yarrick, and I'm taken right back to that dark place. At one point, I pass a building with wide, grand stone steps and old, panelled wood doors, and it reminds me of the courthouse that's not too far from here, and never too far from my mind.
If I find myself walking behind an old lady who holds the hands of two young brown-haired girls, I'll always wonder if that's them, Yarrick and Sarah's daughters, and whether I would recognize them if it was. I would recognize Sarah's mother if I saw her again. She was petite and elegantly dressed each day in court. Her grey eyes were always calm, and that amazed me. She carried herself with such dignity. It was bemusing but admirable how she held herself. I never saw her swearing under her breath or letting tears slip down her cheeks, unlike me. She didn't gape in disbelief as she listened to the prosecution describe Yarrick as a violent narcissist, rocked by sexual jealousy, and unable to bear the idea that, in the last throes of his life, his wife, his property, was finally leaving him, escaping his mental and physical abuse to be with someone kinder. I had to stand up in that witness box and describe my understanding of how her daughter was murdered. But her chin never dropped. It might have done, though, had they shown the simulations in court. I was torn apart in the cross-examination. It was a character assassination, and yet I felt her eyes upon me, watching without judgment. I would have spoken to her if I had known what to say. I smiled at her instead, as we filed down the steps at the end. She was about to make a statement to the press, poised in her heels. But she smiled back, with a warmth that my wishful heart sensed was forgiveness. As we knew it would be, it was a landmark case. Yarrick was found guilty, swiftly and unanimously, on the basis of his ghost memories, just days after the new law came into place. Despite being dead, he was posthumously convicted of murder, and his punishment was the decommissioning of his heaven. He would have to die a second time. I glance at the time. By now, the systematic destruction of Yarrick's heaven is almost complete. Jess invited me to be there, which took me by surprise. I turned down the offer immediately, not even thinking about it for a moment. "I'm done with playing God," I told her. I imagine her disconnecting everything in the electric lab as my feet hit the pavement and my coat flaps at my knees. She is taking his mirror neurons out of their tiny black cartridge and out of the solution that keeps them alive. They will be cremated and buried with the rest of him. Is this justice? I don't know. But it is over. At last it is over. And the darkness is no longer fathomless and engrossing, but crisp like the night sky. I had built a career on delaying the inevitable, on pushing back that obscurity a little bit further. But now, I don't know where to find the light to guide me. Is Leela's heaven everything she was promised? "It looks stable," said Jess. "No ghost memories. Or at least none that she spotted so far." I sigh in relief, but it does nothing to soothe the ache I feel. Leela didn't want to die. She was young, happy. But I remind myself what matters is that she lived, and that she is remembered. That doesn't mean that grieving her is easy. Memories cannot fill her vacancy or ease the sorrow that follows me throughout my days. People like Leela leave us forever, even though they can play in the meadows of their childhood holidays and dance on a bar with their best friends and kiss their husband goodnight again and again and again. They are still gone. I cut down a side street towards Cavendish Square. As I reach the end of Henrietta Place, I can see ahead that the grass is covered by tents and the trees are festooned with lights. As I get closer, the scent of spiced wine warms the air. I glimpse at the time in my vision and decide to cut through the market on my way to Harley Street. An old-fashioned carousel welcomes me, surrounded by parents waving to their little ones and encouraging them to keep their tiny mittened hands on the poles of their horses. There's an orchestral version of a Christmas song being played by a brass band somewhere. The throaty grumble of the tuba sounds live, but I can't see them or put my finger on the name of the song. I hum it in my head with forced jollity, hoping the words will come, but they don't. There are stalls selling gifts and food, and I stop at one to buy a mug of mulled cider. I watch people queuing up for the Belgian waffles opposite, letting the scent of melted chocolate and vanilla blend with the aroma of my drink. I sip at the hot liquid, sucking it back slowly over my tongue to let the spices coat my mouth. It tastes like Christmas. I feel rather alone, standing at the round bar beside the stall. But I shouldn't do. I'm spending the holidays with my sister's family this year. Some people have no one. I think of Leela's husband, and of Yarick and Sarah's two daughters, without their mother or father for the first time. And I feel an intense sadness gather at the back of my throat. I knock back my drink in a few more gulps to try to wash the lump from my throat and leave the mug on the bar. Tightening up my coat, I head onwards, leaving the square behind me. The clinic is a short walk up Harley Street. I've walked past it many times on my way to or from work. I've still got 10 minutes before my appointment, so I decide to walk on further. Oakley Associates is 2 blocks away. I'm so damned sentimental these days. I walk past the tall, smart buildings, surrounded by black iron fencing. I look up at some of the windows and see the occasional cluster of fairy lights or green Christmas tree branches. The old BT tower flashes behind me like a beacon to warn passing ships. The streets here are tightly ordered. It doesn't take long for me to reach the Oakley Associates Clinic, and I stand across the street from the sliding doors, admiring the lime tree that frames the entrance with its branches. The protesters have gone for the day, but the lights are still on inside. And through the glass of the sliding doors, I can see a woman sitting behind the reception desk. She is wearing a dress the colour of Leela's lipstick, and as I stare, she swivels in her chair to reach for something on her desk. Stupidly, my heart falls when it's a face I don't recognise. I can see the window of my office from here, towards the back of the building. I wonder who is inside it now. Harry, perhaps. I hope so. I never told him, but he was really good at his job. I wonder how something I once cared about so much can seem worthless to me. I put my soul into crafting heavens. I fell in love with all my clients a little bit along the way. Is it wrong? What I did? I don't know. Looking at the clinic now from the outside, its value has fallen. The slick lines of its architecture, the gleaming marble floors, the original artwork on the walls. It's all a sham. Life is the only thing of value in this world, especially when war is so imminent. I press my lips together in a silent farewell. I won't come here again. I could pretend not to care, but of course I do. I turn and walk back the way I have come, feeling the cooling air bite at my ears. I still sometimes think that the past 4 months have been a dream. That none of it really happened. But Leela is gone, and that is a constant reminder that the conflict is real and getting ever closer to home. Britain's airstrikes begin in earnest next week. Strangely, the more serious it gets, the better I sleep. It's been weeks since I've woken to the imagined sound of drones or bombs. Most days, I don't even think about it. Is it because I've seen what is beyond? My heaven still taps me on the shoulder, whispers in my ear. It springs upon me when I'm feeling low. It offers me a crutch, and it is tempting to think that I could fall back into that dreamlike oblivion. I have to speak firmly to myself. I have to remind myself that I have a life to live, and that the idea of heaven is not as sweet as it appears. I return to the Harley Street building and walk in through the revolving doors to a tiny Edwardian-era reception. It's carpeted and lined with wood panelling and bookcases. A display appears in front of the door that leads onwards. "Hello, Miss Argent," it says. "Please sit down, and someone will be with you shortly." I do as it suggests, and take a seat in the leather-effect armchair in the corner. I've barely sat down, and the hologram is still fading out, when a woman clad in a white tunic marches into reception to greet me. "Please, this way," she says with polite efficiency. I wordlessly follow her through the door, back into the building, and we enter the second door on the right. I find myself in a white clinic of claustrophobic proportions. She gestures for me to lie down on the bed that fills the longest edge of the room. Half of the space remaining is taken up by the laser machine that stands beside the bed, like a giant angle poise. "Please, if you could roll up your trouser leg to knee height and slip your shoes off." I kick my shoes off onto the floor and pull up the fabric, folding it above my knee. I peel off my socks and drop them on top of my shoes. The woman pounces upon my ankle. "Now let's have a look. You've been using the lotion for a month, correct?" she asks.
"Yes."
"It's worked well." She runs her finger over the remaining outlines. "Yes, I think we'll be able to get rid of the last traces with one session. Please, lie back." She picks up a block and arranges it under my heel so that my foot is elevated. Then she angles the mechanical arm to face the tattoo. "Just relax for 15 minutes, she says, before leaving the room. The main lights dim, and I close my eyes as the machine hums into life. I feel something pointed move over the skin on my ankle. The robot traces the lines on my ankle once, twice, three times, until it is sure and it's decided on the strength and thickness of the ink that remains. It whirs briefly as the laser stutters into life. I can barely feel it tracing my skin, and I remember the pain that Brooke inflicted upon me. I could take pain then. I'm not sure I could be so brave now. But maybe I'm wrong. Maybe I'm stronger in different ways. I do as the woman suggested and close my eyes, feeling my body heat gather between my clothes and the bed. If I am stronger, then no one would know it. I have found it hard to talk to anyone about what I've been through. My sister knows next to nothing, but then she wouldn't ask. There are few other people to tell, although I've had a lot of conversations with Leela in my mind. And even with Yarrick, if I'm completely honest with myself. I've had coffee with friends in the past few weeks, but I've asked most of the questions. I've kept them talking. It's too difficult to know where to begin. They've asked me about work, which is the only thing I used to talk about. It's all they really know about me. And I've stumbled there, more than anywhere, for the first time identifying where my depression has stemmed from. This sudden lack of purpose. What will you do next? Everyone asks. I've listened to myself come out with some bullshit about going travelling for a while or doing some volunteer work, but only to fill in what would otherwise be gaping holes in our dialogue. I should admit to them that I don't know. I should ask them for help, but I don't. That's not the kind of person I am. There is one skill I've taken from all of this. My ability to meditate is phenomenal. I let it happen now. I listen to my heartbeat and I imagine it slowing down. Perhaps it does. With every beat, my thoughts fade to the edges of my brain's vision, out of reach. I lie there, breathing, and for those moments, it's enough to be alive. It's okay to be me. Right, let's have a look then. I barely noticed the door open, but the woman is back beside me and the robot is withdrawing from the bed. The lights fade up and she leans down to inspect my ankle. I hope you won't miss it. It was beautiful. I pull myself into a sitting position and twist my head to look. You would never know there had ever been anything there. All I see is the bare skin, still darker than usual from the Goan sun. I decide that I will put my anklet on when I get home. No. I won't miss it, I tell her. Thank you. I put my socks and shoes back on and make my way out into the crisp December evening. They are closing the clinic behind me. The hologram flickers into darkness and the lights go off as I leave. I stand in the entrance, buttoning up my coat and burying my chin into the collar. My breath warms my neck, only serving to drive the rest of me into a deeper chill. Hello? A voice says, making me start. I didn't see him before, but he's leaning against the wall, wrapped up in a thick parka, pale grey fur framing his face. Daniel? He pushes back the hood as soon as I recognize him. I'm surprised, but not quite as much as I would have expected. Is it done? I ask him, and it's as if I can feel Yarick's hand stroking the skin of my neck. I shake the image away. It reminds me that I am damaged, and that there are lines carved into me that cannot be removed with a fancy cream or a laser. They will mark me forever. Yes, it's done. His mirror neurons have been returned to his family. I'm thankful for the gentleness in Daniel's voice. He drops his eyes, and I can tell that even after seeing what Yarick did, he respects the solemnity of what's happened today. But that's not why I'm here, he continues. No? You said you'd be in touch, he says softly. He sounds hurt. The streetlight shines upon his face, and his smile is uncharacteristically full. I find myself returning it, against my better judgment. But I wasn't. No. He drops his gaze to the pavement. I thought your codex might have corrupted my details, Or I was wrong.
About what?
About you? He levels his gaze at me, and I have to blink the intensity of his eyes away. They speak of things I've long left behind.
When I look back at him, there is something of Yarick in his expression, behind the light in his eyes.
I gulp back the shock and feel as though I've swallowed vodka.
I wanted to check you were all right.
He shrugs. Exhaled air condenses into a mist in front of his face, softening it. I narrow my eyes at him. He's as coldly logical as I usually am. No, he wouldn't have come to find me without a good reason for doing so. Well, I'm fine, so I guess that'll be that. I let out a little laugh, and it comes out awkwardly, as if my diaphragm has forgotten how to hold itself, or my throat is stunned by the sound. I pull my hair out from beneath the collar of my coat and flick it over my shoulders, walking straight past him down the street. He turns and walks next to me, of course. Our hands are thrust deep into our pockets, but Daniel's shoulder rubs against mine as we walk. I hear him sigh.
I'm supposed to hear it. I'm supposed to know that there's a part of me he's giving up on. For now, at least. I wanted you to know that there's a job for you, if you want it.
The softness has gone from his voice. He's only ever one Daniel or the other. I wonder whether the gentle half of him will always be retrievable, or whether that sigh was final. Perhaps that was his last effort at an apology, at any hint of friendship.
We could use you, Isabel.
I make a very unfeminine grunt, which embarrasses me as soon as I hear it.
You might not realize it, but you could be a great asset to a lot of people. To us now, given single opt-in, given the coming changes in the law.
An asset. I turn his choice of word over in my mouth, enveloping it with sarcasm. I can feel his eyes upon me. An asset in a witch hunt? In tearing down people's heavens?
You must be bored. Aren't you?
He smiles again now, and it offers some kind of bridge between the two versions of him. For the first time, I can see both of him.
I don't profess to know you well, but I know you're an intelligent woman, Isabel. You must be desperate to do something.
I think about what the fallout from Yarrick's trial will be in the media. I imagine a swollen crowd of protesters outside the clinic, jubilant with the evidence to bolster their hatred of an artificial afterlife. Who will want a heaven now? I think about what might happen if Valhalla can't find a way to erase ghost memories. Worst of all, I wonder how likely it is that they'll find a way to simply tuck them out of sight, hide them from their simulations, so that only the dead will suffer them. It is conceivable. And if there's a risk of that happening, who will stop them? We reach the junction, and I pause, my toes pointing out into the crossroads. Daniel stops and stands beside me, our breath intermingling in the air between us. I'll think about it, I say, with the same careful delicacy that I feel. And I mean it, because that's exactly what I do, how I help people. I think about things. I run them through in my mind, roll them over and over, shaping them, making memories from them before anything has ever happened. That is how you keep control. That is how you exact perfection. This has been an Audible Studios production of The Memory Chamber, written by Holly Cave and performed by Imogen Church. Copyright by Holly Cave, 2018. Production copyright 2018 by Audible Limited. Audible Studios is a division of Audible Limited.
Audible hopes you've enjoyed this program.